You mentioned the stresses on your officers and you having to tackle international terrorism earlier. Here in Northern Ireland?
Well, we're not...
International terrorism?
Well, we're not remotely complacent about the various threats. And over the last 3 months, there's been three very serious attacks, two in London, one in Manchester. And following the Manchester attack, the threat level in the United Kingdom was only for the second time lifted to critical. And we had to respond to that. You know, it's entirely appropriate that we should respond to that, but that we should look after major transport hubs and where people were collecting. And it's that reassurance prevention that we want to do. We also, as very often reported, we have a land border as well. One has to be aware that people do move through the island of Ireland into GB, and that is a route by which people are trafficked. All sorts of illegal commodities move, and people are trafficked as well. And if that movement can happen, then perhaps threats can emerge.
So let's stay on the international terrorism aspect of this, because you know I've been banging on about this for a few weeks now, and everybody I talk to, everybody, literally, I can't find anybody that says Northern Ireland would be a target for an international terrorist, in other words, ISIS, etc., where you can see how London or major cities throughout the world would be. Do you take that view too? Everybody I talk to say they'll never target Northern Ireland.
Well, we have our part to play in terms of the security of the United Kingdom and indeed of this island, and working very closely with the guards. And so we wouldn't discount that there couldn't possibly be a threat here. There's plenty of world-catching events happening here. We would have big sporting events. We have plenty of VIP visits. We have plenty of very important, you know, people come to our shores now. And all of those individuals may present a target. But what we've seen in these attacks, almost they're self-starter in that they influenced from afar by Daesh, ISIS, and what people seem to take comfort from is that we don't have these, you know, big populations from which these individuals might emerge.
And do you take comfort from that too? Do you think Belfast could be as much a target as any other city in the UK, or less?
Well, I have to go back, and I have to give you an official line. The threat is now severe. And that means an attack is highly likely. And that's how we have to operate, with the thought that the attack is highly likely. That's severe. What the risk is here and how we manage that risk then may be somewhat different, because we're not the big international iconic city that London might be, or London is. And so that moderates what the actual risk could be, but the threat level here is severe, and we police accordingly to that. And we're very clued in to the national picture around how threats are emerging, how they've been dealt with, and we're very clued into the overall national picture around policing and providing our part in support to that national effort.
I'm trying to remember what it was called now. I think it was called Operation Temperor. Where a chief constable, it was at the chief constable's discretion whether he or she could call upon the army,
soldiers to come onto
the ground. And Northern Ireland was excluded from that.
We weren't.
Does that feel political to you?
Well, we weren't excluded as much as the chief constable and the rest of senior colleagues and myself all agreed with this, that we're an organisation which is routinely armed. We do have a lot of experience in terrorism, and we did not see the benefit in actually the deployment of Green Army in such a visible sense.
The one thing that doesn't add up about that,
yeah,
is that you're a force that's stretched in terms of manpower. So why wouldn't you want, at least at your discretion, the ability to bring in extra manpower when the threat level increases or decreases? And quite a few people in Northern Ireland would suggest that's about keeping political stability here and keeping the army off the ground, even if you need them.
People put on all sorts of motives. It's not to say it could never happen, and if we felt it was necessary, we would do it. But in the circumstances that we were viewing, and we had to take into account also then what demands were being made of us in terms of the national arena. And if there have been big demands placed on us for our specialist firearms officers, for instance, we might have, the decision making may have been different. But we felt we had sufficient resources ourselves to manage and reassure people in terms of the critical threat. And it's not to say that means that the deployment of the military is ruled out forever. It's dependent on the circumstances and the threat that we'd face at any one time. And the politics of that really doesn't come into play. What we're about is protecting the public, and that is the first and really only priority in this.
You touched upon earlier the type of society we have and what your officers see, a fractured society. How give me again a sense in terms of those people who are hooked on drugs, who are not able to function because of alcoholism or drug dependency, and what that world is like.
Well, I think for us, this is most stark. We can see it most starkly in terms of the people who come into custody now and how that's changed into our custody suite. So people that we had arrest and bring in. And it is unusual now to find individuals who don't have some form of warning on our systems, and that can be around suicidal tendencies, attempted suicide, or it can be in respect of a drug dependency issue, alcohol dependency issue, or mental health. And those critical issues are becoming more and more prevalent, certainly in the individuals that we are dealing with. And that's very stark in our custody suites. And it's very difficult with these statistics to find a comparator into GB, because people unfortunately are measuring these things differently. But we we needn't console ourselves, oh well, it's better here than Great Britain. It's not, and in some readings of the statistics, it's probably worse here.
Is that hard drugs, or what are we talking about?
Well, I don't believe in the expression hard drugs. Drugs are drugs, and it's not just illicit drugs from cannabis onwards, but also then the abuse of medicine, prescription medicine as well. And with really tragic consequences as well. People are taking a concoction of drugs, not really knowing what's going to be the overall impact, and placing themselves in very life risking situations, as we see almost. And there's a steady, really regrettably, what was very unusual, people dying from drug overdose, has become almost a weekly occurrence now.
Say that again?
Well, what was at one time...
People dying from drug overdose is a weekly occurrence?
Yes, it is, yes. And what happens? Don't all get reported? They're not in the public consciousness. And sometimes individuals die in a public place, and we've seen that recently in fast food outlets, etc. And that goes into the public domain. But more often, people die on their own.
The revealing part, I think, of this interview between us today is here you have, a radio presenter I'm in contact with people every day because of the job I do, and with stories every day. So I think I understand Northern Ireland quite well, and yet I don't. What's revealing today is my naivety, and maybe the naivety of quite a few people listening to this, in that I think they will be shocked by that. And yet the police are saying, you're seeing this.
Well, it is shocking. And I know that you started off with 2012 to 2017, and it just feels very different now from 2012. And, practically for our police officers out on the ground, it feels very different. And
why though, Drew? What is different?
Well, I honestly don't know. I can't put a finger on what has happened within our society. But certainly it does relate to the abuse of drugs and the widespread availability of a whole range of drugs.
It brings us back full circle, doesn't it, in that it's not just your police officers then more stress.
No.
It's society as a whole somehow.
Well, and that might be right. And our figures around stress, I don't think will be very different, you know, from other elements or other elements of the public sector.
Finally, the political instability that there is in Northern Ireland, the lack of an executive in Northern Ireland, is that impacting on the PSNI?
Well, it has impacted very significantly around budget, in that there's no clarity yet, even though we are in the budget year, 17 and 18, we've no clarity about the much money we're going to get this year. We do plan to recruit this year, but our recruitment plans are fluid, because we're not clear what money we're going to have in the autumn going into winter and spring then.
So what do you do?
Well, we are living, I'll not say hand to mouth, because we get our budget every month, but we are living from one month to the next. And the scale of the organisation that we have, it's no way to run an organisation of the size of the PSNI. Really, we need 3 to 5 year budget planning. But that's the same right across the public sector. It's very difficult for the public sector to make plans when they don't know really where they're going to be in 5 or 6 months' time around budget. And the other thing
is... So does that mean you can't recruit or what? Mean you can't do practically?
Well, what it means is that the certainty that we might have had around, here, okay, we've got these amount of officers leaving, so we'll recruit, you know, a corresponding number to replace them. Well, maybe not. We'll have to recruit less than that, because we just don't know how much money we're going to have in the year total. And
so does that mean the PSNI, certainly in the short term, that the manpower level is likely to decrease further until you have certainty?
Well, even given that we have a 3% cut this year, so in around 20 million, so that means the organisation at the 31st of March next year will be in around 6,700 strong there, so that we can manage that. But and one has to make make assumptions about where we're going to be, but we have no certainty. But also then, you know, some of the issues we've been talking about around, say, domestic abuse, additional legislation which has been brought in England and Wales to help protect individuals from those that would abuse them in a domestic scenario. We don't have that yet. We should have had it by now. We need an executive to pass it. So there's additional legislative fixes for this as well.
A lot's been said about what Arlene Foster may bring back after the deal between the Tory party and the DUP. Do you hope to get more money into the police? Is that one of the things that you would want back from this deal?
Well, more money would be very welcome. But I think on top of that, I think all of us in the public sector, not just policing, would like some certainty about what budgets are going to be 3 to 5 years, so that we can plan, and we can plan around the change in demand that has been made, not only of us, because when I'm talking to you about, you know, dependency issues and violence, all of that knocks on into social services and into health service and into education and councils. So all of us in different ways are dealing with the same people, and we need to get around the table. The programme for government set out a mandate and an agenda for how this would happen, and without the executive, we can't implement the programme for government.
Drew, thanks very much for coming in this morning. I think that for me, if I think through the last 30 minutes or so and just some of the things that you've said that I've learnt about today. So we have at any one time 200-odd people being investigated for online child abuse. We have two officers a week, 20-odds a year. Being moved from their homes, police officers, because of dissident and loyalist threats.
Yes.
That in itself is shocking. And the statistic that started us off, the reason that you're in here today, an increase in mental health illness within the PSNI increasing by almost 40% between 2012 and 2016, which is why I want to give just a final comment from you to your officers this morning? Because what this programme often does is question and criticise. So yes. What do you want to say to your officers this morning listening to this?
And yes, you're right. And this is a good way to reach out to a lot of them, both to my officers and staff. What I would say to them is it's really important if you feel that you're under stress, some form of psychological illness, we're there to support you. Speak to your own doctor, speak to your supervisor, make an approach to OHW. Get help. We're there to help you through this and bring you back to the workplace and fully fit for the important role and job that you do.
This is, I promise, the last question because I should have asked it earlier and it's just come into my mind, okay?
Okay.
Given the increase in mental health related stress and illness within police officers,
yes,
is there any extra strategy in taking weapons off those officers, or have you had to do so over the last 4 years? I'm sorry that question has just come into my head, but it has.
Well, yes, we would look at the overall well-being of an officer, and that would include whether they should continue to hold their service pistol.
And have you taken many off officers?
Well, we've taken some. I don't know overall what the statistics are, because each of these are on a case-by-case basis. Some officers voluntarily surrender their service pistol, and in others we make the decision that for the moment the service pistol should be withdrawn. And obviously then we have to put in place a protection and care plan in respect of those. But there's a lot of, even since the 10 months since last year talking about this, we've done an awful lot around support for officers in terms of their well-being and preparing them for the rigours of the occupation. And even in those areas which we know are most stressful, going through a pre-selection process to make sure we have resilient individuals there.
It seems to me that you've listened a lot since 10 months ago to maybe some of the officers' concerns, and you've proactively tried to do something about it.
Yes,
is that fair?
Yes, and I take this area very seriously. I've been involved with our own benevolent fund around the welfare of our officers for 10 years. I've chaired that, and I'm also involved with the Police Treatment Centre. So this is an area personally I take a lot of responsibility in, but I know that very dedicated professionals, both in our Occupational Health and Welfare and our Human Resources Department, commit a lot of their time around engagement in the organisation and the well-being of our staff. And really, ultimately, that is a good thing for us to do. The more healthy and strong our organisation is, the better place we are to protect people here in Northern Ireland.
Drew, thanks for coming in. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.